Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and child protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion. My guest today started his career as a teacher in a local comprehensive school in Blackpool. But as he later admitted, he didn't love it and left the field of education to become a police officer. After 30 years in law enforcement and reaching the rank of chief constable, it's ironic that Mike Cunningham, in some ways at least, returned to education of sorts, becoming the CEO of the College of Policing. Perhaps his biggest challenge, and being part of the policing reform, the people he had to convince were not first-year students, but street-hardened police officers with a lifetime of experience. The college was criticised by some for its proposals and was even threatened with legal action by one of its own. It's certainly been an interested and varied career, and as Mike approaches retirement at the end of this year, he reflects on his own career, the highs and lows of the college and the future of UK policing. I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Chief Constable Mike Cunningham, a very warm welcome today. You studied theology at Durham University before going into teaching. He then joined Lancashire Constabulary and ultimately became the Chief Constable of Staffordshire Police. After a period at a Manchester Inspectorate of Constabulary, he became the CEO of the College of Policing. I'm curious how a teacher decided to devote his life to law enforcement.
Yeah, it's not that unusual in some ways. I enjoyed teaching. I taught in a comprehensive school in Blackpool, and I did it for 2 years, but I didn't love it. And I felt that if you don't love something in your first 2 years, you better have a close look at it. And that's advice I give to people joining the police now. If you don't really love it in your first couple of years, you might want to think about it, because you don't start to love it after 20 years, or very few people do. So I felt as though I needed to do a job that I might really love. And I always had a hankering about the police, a curiosity about the police. No family ever in the police. But I made the leap. And it was a bit of a leap of faith. But I've loved every minute of it.
Well, you clearly are a man of faith. What sort of some of the aspects that appeal to you in police work?
Well, I think I always wanted a job, I think, with contact with people. That's kind of sometimes a bit of a cliche, but I knew that that's what I wanted, to be dealing regularly with people. I liked the idea of the policing mission, which was and is to keep people safe. So that appealed to me vocationally. That I think is a great vocation, to protect people. And I think that's probably why I joined. And that sense of protecting people or keeping people safe, by either keeping bad people away from them or looking at other prevention methods, was always something that's been in my thinking in policing. So, yep, they were the aspirations, and my career hasn't disappointed.
I did a podcast recently on trauma-informed policing, really, where the attitude is changing from bad people doing bad things to perhaps it's good people doing bad things, and looking at how we can basically turn people's lives around from a holistic approach, if you will.
Well, I think, Dave, we encounter different types of criminality, don't we, in policing? So we see people who make mistakes. We see people who have been dealt a very tough hand. We see people who are bad, and we see everything in between that. And I think that's what we as professional people deal with. We have to deal with people and try and understand, is this a mistake? Is this something that people really regret doing? You know, I've seen and encountered many people who have come out of prison or have been convicted of offences, and they don't want to continue a life of offending behaviour. And actually, they need a lot of support to stop it because of the environment they're in or because of addictions that they have. And so what we used to refer to often as offender management, or turning people around from offending, has been something that's really appealed to me. And there are other people we occasionally see in policing who actually need to be locked away for a very long time.
Now, many people have heard of the College of Policing, an organisation that you'll be retiring from at the end of this year. What is it? Why was it set up? And what is its remit?
So the College of Policing is the professional body for policing. And what that means is it's the body that sets the national standards. So professional bodies are there to set the standard and then to put in train frameworks for how people can be developed to professionally deliver those standards. They're standards of operational practice, whether that's interviewing people, whether it's investigating serious offences, whether it's firearms, whether it's public order. Those standards are set by the College of Policing. And we also set in place the curriculum to allow people to be developed to meet those standards. We also set standards for individuals, and that's for recruitment. And no doubt we'll come on to talk about that. But recruitment and progression, so that we have got a clear set of guiding principles that allow people to progress through policing. And we do something else as well in the college as a professional body, and that is we build up the evidence of what works. We are one of the national What Works centres, and what works in crime prevention is something that we're very proud of. And we get tested, evaluated good practice from around the country that we share with other people. So sharing knowledge in policing is also one of our principal roles.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned recruitment, and it's fair to say, however, that some of the aims of the college have caused controversy amongst rank-and-file police officers, with many of them openly critical and mistrusting of the college's aims. In particular, is the new Police Education Qualifications Network and the direct entry scheme for superintendents. So what would you say to those officers?
One thing I would say right at the start is that I think that because the college was set up as part of an overall reforming of police effort on the part of the Home Office, I think that the College of Policing has got off to a start where it has found it difficult to connect with frontline officers. I'm the first to say that. I'd say it from any platform. And that connection with frontline policing is of fundamental importance to everything that we do. So I'm trying to, during my time as chief executive, I've really tried to make that connection much better. And of course, I know that there are some things that we have introduced that some people have kicked against. Mm. So new educational qualifications for people coming into policing. What people automatically think is that I and other people in the College of Policing are on some academic trip where we only want people with academic qualifications coming into policing. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. The way that the PQF started out was to say, let's look at what a good constable does in the 21st century. What skills do they need to manage the amount of information that they have to hold, to make decisions based on that information, to exercise discretion, to use powers over their fellow citizen, to get involved in partnership working and leading partnership working often. And when you look at what is needed to train people for that level of work, to have a curriculum that's fit for purpose, and you build that curriculum, and then you come and say, right, how would you accredit that level of training? You come out with the answer, it's a degree. So actually, it's the degree that recognises the complexities and the level at which officers are working. And I see that as a good thing. I see that as a recognition that what I did as a constable, what you did as a constable, actually are really highly valued things. And if we're going to properly reward the training that you do for that, then the proper reward for that training is the degree. So that's why we landed at it. Now, part of the things that we do in policing in the college is about change. And I get it. People don't like change. And sometimes that change hasn't been well sold or well represented by the college as well. So I take that on board. And we need to do a lot more to get these messages across as to why these things are in place. Let me turn to direct entry, should I, seeing as you've raised it, Dave. So direct entry superintendents, direct entry inspectors are things that we have tried. We have looked to see whether you can actually develop leaders in a different way in policing. And I think that's a very legitimate thing to do. We've had a very traditional way of bringing people through policing in the way that I went through it. You went up through the ranks, and that was fine. That works very well. But are there other things that we can do to get a further mix of people coming into policing? And we've tried direct entry superintendents and direct entry inspectors. And what the evaluation of both of those schemes have told us is that actually it is possible to come into policing and be effective at superintendent or inspector level. But equally what we're seeing is that there's not a huge appetite for it on the part of chief constables. And so we're looking at that to see whether, in fact, the continuation of direct entry superintendents or inspectors is viable going forward, because if chief constables don't take them, then we need to question that.
Why do you think it is that chief constables aren't particularly keen on the scheme?
I think there's two reasons. Some are, and they're very public about it, just against the idea that people can come in that way in the first place. They're few and far between, but there are some of those people. And then there are others who have very few opportunities to promote somebody to superintendent within a year. I was in this position when I was chief constable in Staffordshire. Mm. I had very few opportunities each year to promote people. And I felt that, and other chiefs feel now, that actually to bring somebody in directly actually was problematic for people who were coming through and were really chomping at the bit for that next rank. And so that is proving a bit of a challenge, and we need to look to see whether it's viable going forward. But what I would say is that, and I've met many direct entry superintendents, there are some very, very high quality people who have come in as direct entry, both at superintendent and inspector level. So whatever we do going forward, we need to recognise that some colleagues are making a great contribution having come in that way.
And I think a lot depends on sort of the role that they're going to go into. I mean, just thinking of my own field, if you were to perhaps bring in the CEO of, Children Child Services from a local council, then there's no reason why they wouldn't make an excellent head of public protection unit. But to have somebody, a general manager from Tesco, I apologise for the vague analogy, but to then have them in control of a public order situation may not be appropriate.
So what we're seeing is that people are coming in from very different walks of life. We in fact have people who have been directors of children's services who are very effective in leader. People have come in from law backgrounds, from military backgrounds, from service backgrounds across the way. So a big mix of people have come in to policing in this way. And some are great, and some are competent, and some have found that it's not for them. And that's exactly the same as when other people come into policing. That's always the way you'll get a good mix of skills. But one thing is sure, absolutely vital in all of this, is that we don't want to put people in charge of things without the training for them to do that. So if somebody's going to be a public order commander, they need to make sure they've done the necessary courses and qualifications and have gained the necessary on the job experience before we put them in a situation to manage those things.
Now, we talked a few minutes ago, didn't we, about some chief constables not particularly keen on the various schemes. And I think it was in 2019, the chief constable of Lincolnshire, Bill Skelly, in an exceptional legal move, attempted to take the college to judicial review, accusing the college of ignoring growing evidence that demonstrated the impracticality of your proposals regarding the PEQF. Did you ignore that evidence?
When you look at what we do in the college, we implement standards nationally across England and Wales. And actually, some of our standards are voluntarily taken up by non-Home Office forces and by Scotland and Northern Ireland as well. But let's just stick with England and Wales for the sake of this argument. 43 different police forces. So it is entirely conceivable and happens regularly that if you're going to implement something nationally, at least one of the 43 individuals might disagree with it. You know, if it's change, if it's new, if you've got a room with 43 people in it and you're trying to sell something new, then it is often the case that somebody will disagree. With regard to the legal challenge from Lincolnshire, yeah, you're absolutely right. Lincolnshire police did attempt to take us to judicial review. It fell by the wayside. The judge deemed that it was out of time, and it didn't progress. But we absolutely haven't ignored the evidence. We would have fought very hard, and I'm very confident we'd have been successful in actually maintaining our position. At the end of the day, we need to convince chief constables and other leaders that what we are doing is the right thing. We don't actually have to in law. We are the people who set the regulations in law. That's our role. But of course, I want to convince chief constables it's the right thing to do. And sometimes that hasn't been possible.
Well, just to go back, we didn't have the review in the end, as you say, it ran out of time. But I think some of the key points that Mr. Skelly Rose was that he was concerned about some of the abstraction rates that would result, the cost of the scheme, and the amount of time taken out for training, and indeed finding assessors that were suitably qualified to assess the candidates.
A couple of things on this, really. One of the things that I think we need to think about a lot in policing is how much we value training. When I joined in the late 80s, there used to be a saying, this was before the Gulf Wars and the rest of it, when the army and the military were not engaged in so many international wars, that the army trained and trained and trained and never fought, and the police fight and fight and fight and never train. And when you look at actually what the training requirement is for officers, if they don't specialise, it's very limited. And very often, police officers, senior police officers, will talk about the cost of training rather than the investment in training. And I think it's really important if we want to have people who are fit for purpose, who have got the very best skills available to them, who we value, and undertake continuous professional development as they go through, then we've got to have a different approach to developing people. I'm not being silly about this. We don't want people to be always in training, but actually we do need to value it, because actually that's what makes people fit for purpose for the job that they're doing. And I don't think that training is sufficiently valued in policing.
I suppose the other argument would be that, and I can hear the police officers that listen to this now saying that perhaps we need less academics and more thief takers.
Yeah, and I go back to the point that this whole issue about people coming into policing under the new way is not about academics. It's about recognising the complex role of a police officer in the 21st century and making sure that they have the training. Everybody agrees, by the way, even in Lincolnshire, that the old way of training recruits coming into policing was out of date. And we need to modernise it. When you modernise it and you throw in things like vulnerability, when you throw in stuff like digital training, when you throw in something about data handling and complexity and all of the things that modern police officers have to face, and you train people appropriately, then the correct accreditation is a degree. Now, there's loads of thief takers still coming into policing, and that's the way it should be.
At the beginning of this interview, we were discussing about when the College of Policing was set up and how things were communicated, and I'd just like to go back to the direct entry. I know at the beginning of 2019, there was an advert that went out, and I know, I'm pretty sure you know which one I'm talking about, it basically advertising direct entry, and the last bit of the advert was searching for a varied and exciting career where you don't have to start at the bottom. This caused a lot of anger amongst officers, and to your credit, you issued an apology and had the advert removed.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say is that, and I think as I mentioned before, Dave, I'm the first person to say that we in the college have made mistakes. That was a mistake, and as soon as it was pointed out to me, I made sure it was taken down, and as you say, I issued the apology. And I'd like to think that we've come on a long way. That was in January 2019, it was 18 months ago, and I would hope that people listening to this have looked at our new website, they've seen our new approach to communication, and I hope during my time as CEO that we have made some improvements here. Every organisation, not just those in policing, will occasionally get things wrong. We're no exception. That was an example of when we got it wrong. Mm. And I hope that my apology was properly accepted and we've moved on. But up and down the country, when police officers make mistakes, I want us to be there to support them, learn from it and move on. I think we should allow each other to have a break every now and then. And I think with the proviso that people are entitled to say to me, if that mistake were to happen again and again, then I'm not learning the lessons. But I hope we've demonstrated that we are learning the lessons.
As you quite rightly say, an apology was issued, but I think a lot of people felt that it showed, in their opinion at least, that perhaps they weren't being valued. What are the college doing to try and reverse that opinion?
Yeah, so if you look at what we've done in the past couple of weeks, for example, on our website, on the products that we're putting out there, we're putting out really fantastic stories about people's experience of working in policing, because we want to share that. We want to share the learning. We want to let people know what's really great about British policing. I speak to people across the country about British policing. I consider myself to be an ambassador of British policing. I've been in policing for over 30 years. It's something that I am a passionate supporter of, and would want that to be demonstrated in everything that we do. The other thing I think that we're doing is providing better, much better quality training for people going through. We are showcasing good practice and sharing through things like the product that we've got on our website, Going Equipped, which showcases the very best work that's out there. So we're doing a lot to advocate for policing and frontline officers as well. And I think that's the space that we need to occupy.
What would you say to people that would argue that perhaps we should be developing the people that are already in the police service rather than bringing people from outside?
Well, bear in mind, in terms of bringing people from outside, this refers back to direct entry. I have the numbers. I think we've had a total of 33 superintendents direct entry and 72 inspectors direct entry. We're hardly flooding the service with direct entry people. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people who progress in policing come through the traditional routes of from constable up to chief constable. And so we are absolutely committed to developing people in the service.
I think I've given you enough of a grilling. As you approach retirement and as you look back on your time in law enforcement, what have been the biggest changes that you've seen, and what are some of the big changes do you think we can expect in the future?
I think there's two things for me here, really. One is the big obvious shift towards vulnerability. I mean, I think we always had that to a degree in policing, but that's a very obvious and explicit step that forces have now taken to be very clear about the emphasis on vulnerability. And I think both you and I know from our time over the decades policing that there have been instances when very vulnerable people, victims of domestic abuse, victims of child sexual exploitation, sometimes received poor service from policing. And sometimes those offences were hidden in plain sight because we were chasing targets in other areas. So that shift towards vulnerability is something which I think is hugely important going forward. The second thing, and this is where I think we'll continue to change, is the advances in digital technology. I mean, we must be seeing this everywhere. People listening to this in terms of evidence gathering now, the means of people conducting criminal offences, the opportunities that exist for policing to defeat those criminal offences. I see this as a growth area for policing going forward. It's been a seismic shift in how we communicate, how we speak to each other, how we transact business, how we shop, how we do our banking, how we book our holidays, but also how people offend and how we need to protect people from offending. So I think there's much more work to be done in that area, Dave, and I think that's something that will continue to challenge policing.
It's interesting you mentioned technology. I think Oscar Kilo are doing an online webinar tomorrow on how technology is affecting the well-being of officers. And certainly it's taken the office out of the office and into the car and onto the street. And that can lead to isolation, I suppose, can't it?
I think that isolation bit, that where we've previously had teams of people coming together to be briefed, to be debriefed, to be socialising after the event, to be in parade rooms and briefing rooms together. There is a risk, at least, that technology becomes much more individual and leads to that individual approach. And that is something we need to be really mindful of. I'd be very interested in the Oscar Kilo results on that work, because we need to look at that very closely.
Mm. Well, talking of isolation and sacrifice, I suppose, a police career at any rank is, in my opinion at least, a personal gift to society. What personal sacrifices have you had to make in the last 30 years?
I think that the one thing that, I'm sure this will resonate with many officers, is that I can look back with not a great deal of pride with the fact that I have missed things with my family that I shouldn't have done. You know, there have been family events where I have chosen, actually, to sometimes be at work when I could and should have been at other places. Sometimes you have to do that because that's the job, and it's 24/7, 365 days a year. I have done my share of that over the years. So you miss things from necessity. And sometimes you miss things because you believe you have to be elsewhere. And I sometimes look back and think, I may not have got that balance right, if I'm being very honest with myself. And so that's a sacrifice. And sometimes I think that that may have been a bit selfish on my part as well, to be honest, to wanting to do the work stuff rather than some of the family things. So, yeah, as I approach retirement from policing, that's a balance I will seek to redress.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
This is Radio Nightjack and the Thin Blue Mind podcast.
This is Radio Nightjack, broadcasting from a secure and comfortable location somewhere in the northwest of England. Some good news from the front this week. For a number of years now, police officers in many constabularies have been forced to abandon the traditional flat cap with the checkerboard band around it, or indeed the traditional policeman's helmet, in favour of what's known as the bump cap, which, to all appearances, is a baseball cap with a kind of foam rubber insert, which might lessen the blow somewhat if someone was to hit you on the top of the head. Now, in Lancashire, where I worked, officers are now allowed to go back, if they want, to the flat cap or to the female officer's bowler cap, both of which are traditional and recognisable police uniform, part of the authority, I guess, in the uniform that's built up over decades of them being used. Sadly, we're not back to the traditional custodian helmet yet. One can live and hope. There's perhaps cost implications in going forward with a custodian helmet. Still, you've got to make the most of these small changes for the better. And I know that generally across the constabulary, the new hat has been extremely well received by the rank and file members of the constabulary. It's a good thing. It's somebody, perhaps our police and crime commissioner, perhaps our new chief constable, looking at the uniform and how the uniform has changed and saying some of these changes haven't been for the better. Some of these changes don't make us look smarter, don't give the right impression of authority that a police uniform should carry with it, and they've taken a step back where they can. When I look back when I joined the constabulary, I wasn't quite issued with a cape. I'm not that old, But I had a gabardine, black gloves, two or three tunics, three or four pairs of the awful black worsted wool trousers which we had. And those trousers had a pocket on the inside for your truncheon and a pocket at the front for your handcuffs. I had the custodian helmet, I had the flat cap. I had, at one stage, a NATO pattern jumper, like an army jumper that used to be on your action man, but in blue with checkerboards on it. Pale blue shirts, lots of those, and clip-on ties. When I retired back in January, I had black cargo pants. I had black Altberg boots, Constabulary issue, and they are superb. It's one of the great things about working for my old employer. We got proper boots, comfortable and well-made. We had the black wicking shirts, which quickly become stinking unpleasant. I had black body armour, a yellow body armour cover, a couple of yellow jackets, one for summer, one for winter, and a black, I suppose, fleecy jacket, which was okay. But none of it really had the same air of authority about it, I would say, as the tunic, or even the old Gore-Tex anorak, which we used to have, or, God forbid, the strenuous, it's called, a sort of a faux leather jacket, much beloved by the support unit in Lancashire. Anyway, I digress. We've gone, in the course of my service, from being in something that is recognisably UK police, recognisably a British unarmed police uniform, to something that is, frankly, paramilitary. I wrote a piece back in 2009 called Truncheons to Tasers, and that's kind of the direction that we've gone in. Now, it's fair to say that underneath the paramilitary kit of the social worker of last resort, you've still got somebody who wants to police, who has the interests of his fellow man at heart, who wants to do a good job at policing. And the protection offered by the new kit is certainly better than what was offered by the kit when I first joined. If nothing else, we've got bulletproof, stab-proof vests now, and it's perhaps a shame it had to come to that, but it had to come to that. And there's some steps you can't take backwards. But let's be grateful for the small incremental wins that we have every now and then. And when somebody in authority looks at an aspect of police uniform and says, that's not right, I'm not happy with it, I'm going to change that. Even if it costs me a bit of money, I'm going to take us back to where we were before, because back to where we were before is a better place to be. Anyway, that's my thoughts. I'm glad it's happened. And this is Radio Nightjack saying thank you and goodbye wherever you are. Take care.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. The podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.